for him to the other side while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Now when evening came, he was there alone. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the winds or by the waves, for the wind was contrary. Now in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It's a ghost!" And they cried out for fear. I'm going to stop there for just a moment, because I want to think with you about this. I think it's important for us to put ourselves in these men's place. They're out on the Sea of Galilee, and from what I understand, I've never been there, but from what I understand, storms are constant as far as coming in, and they can rise up suddenly. And these men are in a small fishing vessel. You know, we sometimes don't think about the size of this boat. It's not some kind of a ship. It's a small fishing vessel. It may or may not have a sail, as you see in the picture that I've depicted. But it's nighttime. It's the middle of the night. The fourth watch is between 3 to 6 a.m. And here they are. They're in the middle of the Sea of Galilee. And if we look at what John adds, he says they're about 3 to 4 miles out. They're not just rowing on the middle, you know, on the side of the coastline there. They're about 3 or 4 miles out. And a storm comes. Now, I've been on a ship in the middle of the night when it got stormy. And it's quite the experience. On a good night, if you have stars and if you have the moon, you can see a little bit. But now the clouds are covering that. And so the only light that they might have would be maybe a lantern if they can keep it lit. They have very little light. And the water is coming over the sides of this boat. And they are rowing for their lives. How would you feel? I'm sure all of us would be frightened. And then what happens frightens them even more. Imagine you're in this predicament and you're looking out there and you're rowing and you're trying to get to the other side, and suddenly you see this shadow and it looks like it's approaching the boat. You're 3 to 4 miles out. And this shadow is getting closer. And as that shadow becomes closer, you can tell it's the silhouette of a person. Now, these guys are going to say, "Oh, yeah, that's Jesus." No. How many of you would expect somebody in the middle of the Sea of Galilee, 3 or 4 miles out, to be walking out there to you? And so this is not expected. They're not expecting Jesus. And so their first reaction is, "This is a ghost." But Jesus says to them in verse 27, "Be of good cheer. It is I. Do not be afraid." And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." And Jesus said, "Come." And when Peter came down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. And then those who were in the boat came and worshiped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." What a scene that is drawn here for you and me. Jesus, out on the middle of the Sea of Galilee, walking to his disciples. But I want to ask you a question, and I think this is a question perhaps we don't ask ourselves enough. What was the purpose of this miracle? Jesus never performed a miracle without a purpose. Was the miracle to enhance his ministry? Was he trying to convince unbelievers? We know that's not the case. The only people in the boat are his disciples. They've seen Jesus heal the sick. They've seen Jesus casting out devils. They've seen Jesus feed the crowd. They've seen Jesus raise the dead. So what is Jesus trying to do here? What is his purpose? I want to suggest to you that Jesus is attempting to impress upon the disciples, his apostles, his power. And why is that so important? It's so important because he's going to go away. And when he goes away, he is going to entrust these 12 men, minus Judas. He's going to entrust these men to continue his work. And so it is imperative that these men understand the power that Jesus possesses and that they trust him implicitly, because they need to be able to persuade other people. They have to have the ability to persuade other people, and that can't be unless they themselves have that kind of confidence. Maybe there's a lesson there for me and you. How much confidence and trust and understanding of Jesus do we have? Do we understand how powerful he is? Because if we don't have that conviction, how can we persuade others? But I want to suggest to you that there's also another purpose that Jesus would have had for performing this miracle. And that is, he wanted, through this event, he wanted these men to understand what they could do when they trust Jesus. Because when Peter says to the Lord, "Lord, if it's you, call me out," Jesus said, "Come on." And so Jesus wanted to impress upon Peter and these men the great things that they could do if they would allow him to work in them and through them. But I want to think with you for just a moment about the 11 men who were in the boat with Peter. Think about that for just a moment. You're in the boat with Peter, and Peter says to the Lord, "Lord, if it's you, call me out." And Jesus says, "Come on, Peter." And Peter starts out putting his leg over the side of the boat. What would you have been thinking about Peter? 3 miles out in the middle of this body of water, and it's storming like crazy, and this guy's going to get out of the boat? I know they were thinking, "Peter, have you lost your marbles? You must be nuts." But you know what I find? I find that any time that we do something out of the ordinary, that seems to be the reaction of the brethren. "Are you crazy?" Back in 1989, I was at the Florida College lectures with my first wife that passed away. We were praying about going overseas and doing some work. And so this was January of 1989, and so we're sitting at the Florida College lectures, and they have an announcement at the intermission that said, "If you're interested in going to China, come to this meeting and we'll give you details." My wife and I looked at each other. We said, "Hey, there's the answer to our prayers." We went to the meeting. There were 27 people at that meeting. You know how many people went to China out of those 27? Two. Me and my wife. But let me tell you about that for just a moment. We made the plan that we would leave North Carolina. That's where we were living and working at the time. We said we would leave North Carolina in June of 1989, make our way across the country, saying goodbye to our family, asking the brethren to help us financially. If you're a historian of contemporary history, you'll remember that June of 1989 was Tiananmen Square uprising. And so on the big tube every night, the headlines of the news showed all the tanks and everything at Tiananmen Square, and I'm going across the country with my family, two girls that are 3.5 years old, my wife, and I'm talking to the brethren about going to China, and they're looking at me and they're going, "Are you crazy?" I had people tell me, "You're being irresponsible. You have these little children and your wife, and you're going to go across to China when it's like that?" And I said, "The Lord didn't say, go preach the gospel when it's convenient." But people looked at that, and many people in these different congregations refused to help me because they said I was irresponsible. See what I mean? Peter, they probably thought he was crazy. That happened again to me later on in life when we were about to be empty nesters and two children came up for adoption. And these children had major problems. And we looked at those children, and my wife, first of all, when I said, "What do you think about this?" She said, "There's no way." And I said, "Well, when the Lord opens the door, we actually have to think about it." And so we prayed about it, and those two children came to live with us, and we adopted them a year later. But you know, people said, "You're crazy. You're just about to have your freedom. I mean, you've waited your whole life to get those kids raised and out the door, and now you're going to bring in some more?" You see, the Lord has His plan for our lives, and sometimes it's calling us to do something out of the ordinary, and sometimes something that may not be comfortable for us. The question is, will we answer? I want to suggest to you that there's never true faith without stepping out and taking a risk. We need to have faith, brethren. We need to have confidence in Jesus, in the power that He has to work in us and through us. When I went to North Carolina to work with the church there, they had one Bible class teacher on Sunday morning and Wednesday night. And that person taught class until he died, and then they found somebody that they could conscript, and they dragged him in to do the next one. And that's the way it was. And I said, "Guys, we need to get things going here. We need to get some participation." "Oh, we can't do that. I don't know how to teach class." And I said, "You know, there's an old saying that my mama gave me, practice makes perfect." And by the time I left that congregation, we were not a very big congregation. There was only about 50 or so at the time that I left. But we had rotations in the Bible classes every 6.5 weeks. And we had men who were going in and out of that rotation. We had women in the back that were going in and out of that rotation. And we were rotating preachers. I only got to preach about once or twice a month because we had that many people. There were 5 men who were preaching when I left there. And guess what? They don't have a located preacher anymore. Why? Because they have grown to a point that they don't need that. Now, if I were to come here, I'm going to tell you right up front, that would be my goal, to work myself out of a job. Because we need to be self-sustaining. There needs to be teachers among the group here who are willing to step up and to do what needs to be done. And so the question is, are we willing to get out of the boat? You see, there are boat sitters and there are water walkers. And nobody likes to get out of the boat because it is not comfortable. It's getting out of our comfort zone and stretching ourselves. But we need to have enough faith to do what God asked us to do. I want to read a quick story to you. I love this. In the 19th century, the greatest tightrope walker in the world was a man named Charles Blondin. And on June 30th, 1859, he became the first man in history to walk on a tightrope across Niagara Falls. There were over 25,000 people there gathered to watch this man walk suspended 1,100 feet above the water. 160 feet above the water, 1,100 feet across the rope. And the slightest fall would be fatal. When he reached the Canadian side, the crowd burst into a roar. Then he came back and he did it again in 1860. But he became the first person to go across that Niagara Falls, this time pushing a wheelbarrow, holding a sack of potatoes. Everybody is oohing and aahing. Wow, look at this guy. He is so great. And then he asks the crowd. He turns to the crowd and he says, let me ask you a question. Do you believe that I could do this with the wheelbarrow carrying a person across here? And everybody says, yeah, we know you can do it. He says, I need a volunteer. How many of you would have volunteered? You see, we're really good at saying, I believe in Jesus. I believe that Jesus can do anything in my life if he wants to. But then when it comes to getting out of the boat, we become fearful. I believe one thing we have to be careful about is making sure that we are called for what we're doing. In the religious world today, we can see very readily that the religious world has gone crazy by thinking, well, everything is good. Let's do this. Let's do this. And it doesn't matter whether God's authorized it or not. Even the churches of Christ, that's happening. Peter waited for Jesus to say, come. We have to make sure that what we're doing is authorized by our Lord. If you remember, back in the Old Testament, David wanted to build a temple for the Lord. And Nathan the prophet said, sure, that's a great idea. Go for it, David. And God said, wait just a minute. He's not the one to build my temple. And so we have to be careful that what we're wanting to do is what the Lord would have us to do. And that's why I operate the way I do. Because I don't want to just pick out a church. I hear preachers say, well, my grandchildren are over here. I'm going to go preach here. Oh, that's lovely. And you can still preach there, but I'm not sure that that's what the Lord would want you doing. I think what the Lord wants us to do is say, where do you want me, Lord? And if it happens to be where my grandchildren is, that's fine. But if it happens to be in China, then I'm going. And so let's be careful about that. But I want you to think about this for a moment. We, most of the time when we talk about Peter here, we say, wow, Peter began to sink. But if you go back and you read what it says in verse 29, it says that Peter walked on the water. Sometimes we say, only one person's ever walked on the water. No, no, no. Two people did. Peter did. How did he do it? Because he's such a righteous guy and he's got power of his own? No. He knew that the power to go out of that boat, to get out of that boat and to walk on that water, that belonged to the Lord. And when the Lord said, come, he got up and he went because he had trust and confidence in the power of Jesus. And he walked on water, folks. we need to look at what we call our Bible heroes and understand that their trust and their confidence is how they did the great feats that they were able to do. When David went out and he met Goliath with his sling and five stones, he wasn't worried about, oh, well, you know, those five stones, they're going to be what kills this guy. What did he say? When he went out to Goliath, he says, the battle is not mine. The battle belongs to the Lord. When we understand these things, then we can do great things for the Lord. When Nehemiah was rebuilding the walls of the temple, as the people have come back, he shares with them the great things that God had done in his life. And as they went about reconstructing this wall, they were able to accomplish this in an amazing 52 days. I want you to think about both of these events. There's not a miracle there. There's not a miracle in David killing Goliath. There's not a miracle in the walls being rebuilt. It's simply God working through these men to accomplish his will because they trust him and they yield themselves to him. And when you and I do that, we too can do great things. I'm reminded of the Apostle Paul. Probably the most successful and most energetic evangelist ever. He was the persecutor of the church. And then he turns to the being of the Apostle Paul when the Lord appears to him. I find it really interesting. The accusation that is made against Paul in Acts 17 and verse 6. This man has turned the world upside down. Would anybody say that about you or me? They did Paul. Was it because Paul was an inspired man who was given miraculous powers? No. It was because of what he says here in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 12, or chapter 1 and verse 12, he said, I know whom I have believed, and I am persuaded that he is able to keep that which I have committed unto him against that day. And even as he stood there facing death in 2 Timothy, he says, I've fought the good fight. I've finished the course. I've kept the faith. And henceforth, he said, is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord will give to me in that day, and not to me only, but to all who have loved his appearing. This is what God says. God says, call to me. And I will answer you, and I will show you great and mighty things which you do not know. I want to ask you, brethren, has God changed since these words of Jeremiah were penned? Was that only a promise to the prophet, or is that a promise to you and me? Well, let's look at Ephesians, and let's think about this for just a moment. Ephesians chapter 3. I love this verse. It's a verse that should resonate in your soul. In Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 20, now to him, speaking of Christ, now to him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us. Let me ask you a question. Was this written only to the Christians at Ephesus? Was this written only to the people that lived during the New Testament dispensation where miracles were existent? Or is this a verse that applies across time to all of us who will yield ourselves to God and let him work in us and through us to do great things. Do you believe that Jesus is working in your life today? I know he is in mine. I could go and I could tell you story after story after story. And one of them is right here. How Wendy and I are together today. And if you want to know about that, I'll be glad to tell you. If you want to know about some of my other stories, I'll be glad to tell you. Because what that does when I see these things, it bolsters my confidence and my faith that I know that God's working. And so many times people accuse me and they don't really accuse me. They quietly accuse me. Wow, he's really gone off because he thinks God did this or God did that. I know God put us together. I know God did great things that sent me to China. I know that God did great things that sent me to other countries around the world. I know that he's been working in my life. I know that he's the one who sent 3 kids to me to raise and to love and to teach who were not my blood children. I want you to think about this. Is God limited? Since miracles are not happening today, is God limited? We talk about providence and God being active in our lives. Why pray if you don't believe he's working? If it doesn't make a difference, why pray? I have actually heard a Christian tell me, I don't think that the sick get any better because of our prayers. I'm going, how in the world can you be a Christian? How in the world, why in the world would you ever pray if you don't think it makes a difference? Can you change the mind of God? Hezekiah did. God said, you're going to die. And Hezekiah prayed and he gave, the Lord said, I give you 15 more years. When my wife was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. If you know anything about pancreatic cancer, about 6 months is about what you can expect at the max. She was still with us for 2 years. It wasn't easy 2 years, but she was there. And we had time to say goodbye. We had time to share with family. She had time to show her faith and her confidence in God as she was facing death. God kept her alive for that time. And then he took her home to be with him. Paul prayed that the Lord would give him utterance that he could speak the word boldly. You ever pray like that? Paul prayed that God would open doors of opportunity to share the gospel with him or with others. Do you and I pray about that? God was entreated by Paul to deliver him from wicked men. He said himself, Paul said, he has delivered me from the mouth of the lion. And he stated with confidence that the Lord would deliver him from every evil work. Did that mean that he was never persecuted? We know better than that. Did that mean that everything was just rosy in his life? We know better than that. But God was working through Paul, and he was protecting Paul to accomplish his will. And when Paul's use for God was done, then God allowed his death. Can you and I not expect the same in our lives? I say we can. God can do great things. But it's really important, as Peter found out. And as we know from Matthew 14, we've got to keep our focus on the Lord. We've got to keep our eyes on Him. And we can't afford to let doubt cause us to waver. I've been to a lot of different churches, preached in a lot of different places, and this is what I often hear. We've tried all of these different things to reach out with the gospel in our community, and it doesn't work. And so these people give up. They quit trying. And that's what the devil wants. The devil wants us to quit trying. And he wants us to be defeated. And he wants us to quit trying to let our light shine the way that we should, because not only does that cause other people to lose their soul, but it will cause us to lose our own soul, because that is what God says you and I should be doing. Sharing the gospel with other people. Keep your eyes on the Lord. And as we close today, I want to submit to you that Jesus has called you and me to step out of the boat. He wants us to know that we can do great things when we put our confidence and our faith in God into action. And if we do that, perhaps, even in Lakeland, we can turn this community upside down. Maybe you're here today and you're not a Christian. Do you have faith and confidence in Jesus, the one who died for your sins? He said if you're willing to confess that faith and to be buried in the waters of baptism, you can have your sins washed away and you can live a life of service, doing great things, not because you're good, but because he is good and he is powerful. If we put our trust in him. Maybe you're here and you're discouraged. Look back at Jesus and get out of the boat. If we can help you today in any way, would you come while together we stand and sing?
Sunshine of love without rain.